Everyone is marking the anniversary. Seems kind of strange to call it an anniversary. Anniversaries are usually marriages and things like that, ordinations and years of service. 2 years to the day since that day that we will all remember, everyone who was around for it, September 11th. We're going to spend some time during these 3 hours of Issues Etc. today reflecting on those 2 years, on those events, and the aftermath. At the beginning of the program with Dr. Gene Edward Veith, we'll be reflecting there a bit. He has written several books, including one called Christianity in an Age of Terrorism, a book that was written largely in response to the events of September 11th and the aftermath. In the second half hour of the program, Jennifer Roback-Morsch joins us. She's from the Hoover Institute. We're going to talk about the hookup culture, sex as recreation, sex as sport. We'll see what she has to say about that. And then in the second hour of the program, Pastor Tim Pauls, The Vocation of a Soldier. We usually think of soldiering either as something that people do as guard or reserves, their regular vocation lies someplace else, or that someone does for a certain amount of time in their life. They get out of the military and they go on to do what they want to do. Well, whether someone is in the reserves or in the guard or active full-time duty, soldiers have a vocation. It has some rather unique qualities to it, but it is a vocation that God has created, and we'll have Pastor Tim Pauls of Good Shepherd Lutheran Church in Boise, Idaho, tell us about that in the first part of the second hour of the program. A little later then, we're going to be continuing our ongoing conversation with the author of our Issues Etc. Book of the Month for September, the Concordia Commentary on Colossians. Dr. Paul Dieterding will join us to talk about the doctrine of Christ, baptism, and the end times teachings of the book of Colossians. And then a little later, we'll round off our conversation talking with Dr. Albert Moeller, again reflecting upon this day and the event of 2 years ago with Dr. Albert Moeller of Southern Baptist Theological Seminary in Louisville, Kentucky. Our phone numbers are 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727, 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Dr. Gene Edward Veith is a regular guest here on Issues Etc. He's professor of English and director of the Cranach Institute at Concordia University in Mequon, Wisconsin. If plans hold out, we will be broadcasting live from Mequon, Wisconsin here in October. The date has yet to be set for sure. He is also culture editor of World Magazine and author of several books, including Christianity in an Age of Terrorism. Dr. Veith, welcome back to Issues Etc.
Yeah, good to be with you again.
Your thoughts this day as you look back over 2 years, and especially as you look back to the events that has everyone counting the years, the first September 11th?
Well, I've been trying to figure out, have we forgotten it? What about that time that in many ways brought us together as Americans and kind of refocused our thoughts into some more facing the more serious, not just life and death issues, but moral issues and national issues and issues that are very different from just the sort of peace and prosperity, have a good time mindset that we had before.
What's your conclusion? Have we forgotten?
Well, I think to a certain extent we have, and to a certain extent we haven't. It still remains. I mean, we are at war. We have family members and friends and people, there are many of us, and I know even my students, have so many connections with people who are getting shot at in Iraq right now. And so in one way, I think, as a nation, we have been at war ever since 9/11, and we still are. And there's a certain seriousness of purpose, and a certain realization that we do not live in a safe world. This is a dangerous world, and sometimes when you face questions like that, it forces you into some kind of important considerations about life and death and the meaning of life and how God fits into it and everything else. So that's definitely a strain now, and that's different from what we had before 9/11. On the other hand, we have forgotten to a certain extent. We've lost our national unity. Now we're very polarized, again, at least politically, but also culturally. You have the old, even to the point of people, and it's this issue that remains the catalyst, because you have people now, at least among some of our intellectual class, and questioning America, saying that America deserved what happened. You have a lot of criticism now about our efforts to fight terrorism, and so a lot of that national unity has given way to the normal bickering back and forth. Right after 9/11, the churches were full. We were having days of prayer. Everybody was united. Even the press was saying, when they'd interview a victim's family, they would say, God bless you, or we're praying for you. And now church attendance has fallen back to what it was. Actually, I think it's a little bit lower than what it was right before 9/11. And so in some respects, I think America has tried to get back to normal, including the sense of normalcy and, not worrying so much about our safety and worrying about flying and those kinds of things, but also getting back to normal in some of our normal kinds of plain politics and our normal secularism and our normal indifference to the issues of faith. But in another sense, there's something that can't be denied, a strain that's still with us, a sense of being at war, and the realization that this isn't over, that something else could happen, and that we need to be ready to deal with that.
Let's talk about this from two different perspectives, or in two different realms. Let's talk about the major legacy of September 11th in the culture, both the best legacy and the worst legacy. How would you describe the best legacy of September 11th in the culture?
Well, the whole trend of postmodernism that we were in before has been challenged and maybe dealt a death blow by 9/11. By that I mean the sense of relativism. The truth is relative, that you create your own truth, that morality is relative, that there are no absolutes, that all cultures are equally valid, and the whole understanding that defined the whole era. It's called postmodernism, the sense of relativism. When those planes crashed into those buildings, first of all, that was a reality that we didn't create ourselves. That wasn't something that just happened in our mind. That was something that came from the outside, crashing into our consciousness, just like crashing into those buildings, and it can't be denied. And it wasn't something we wanted, wasn't created by our will, and so it challenged that. It challenged the idea of moral relativism, because here we were face to face with evil, with hatred so great to kill innocent people. For just as an act almost of vandalism, that you have to see as something evil, objectively evil. And, a postmodernist would say, but it was right for them. It was right for the terrorists. That's their culture. That's their religion. All of a sudden, you talk that way and apply it to terrorism, it doesn't make much sense anymore.
Then what is the worst effect in the culture, the worst legacy of September 11th culturally?
Well, I think it's sort of related to the other. We're seeing almost a backlash of an even more extreme postmodernism, because people now are saying, some people are saying, this was caused by religion. This was caused by people who believed in absolute morality, and see how dangerous it is to believe in absolutes. The reason the terrorists were wrong, at least they have to admit that the terrorists are wrong, and that's some progress, but they say it is because of their intolerance, because of their belief in one truth. And then the next step is, and other people believe in one truth too, and one morality, like Christians, and really Christians are no better than than the fundamentalists of any religion, and that the real problem is that. And so, among some people, there's a sort of a hesitance in accepting any kind of truth. In other words, trying to sort of hold on to the appearance of, when instead of saying all religions are equally right, they're saying all religions are equally wrong. Both of them are forgetting that you have to look at what the religion is, what the ideology is, what the moral position is. And instead of looking at the content, they're kind of evading that and sort of taking shelter in a kind of a cloudy kind of belief that they're trying to then make their ideology.
We're talking with Dr. Gene Edward Veith about the two-year anniversary of the terrorist attacks on September the 11th. If you'd like to join us, 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Dr. Gene Edward Veith is professor of English and director of the Cranach Institute at Concordia University in Mequon, Wisconsin. He's culture editor for World Magazine, and he's also author of several books, including his latest called Christianity in an Age of Terrorism. He is also, as I said, the director of the Cranach Institute at Concordia University in Mequon, Wisconsin. You can check out the website for the Cranach Institute by simply visiting our website. The address is issuesetc.org, issuesetc.org. Under the section titled Links with Regular Guests, you'll find a direct link to Dr. Gene Edward Veith and the Cranach Institute. Dr. Veith, you talked about the best and worst legacies of September 11th in the culture. Let's talk about the church. What's the best legacy of September 11th in the church?
Well, it certainly brought matters of faith into the public consciousness again. We'd lived in a secularist world, thinking that, well, religion is just something that goes on inside people's heads and it doesn't really matter for practical living, and that we don't have to consider kind of religious issues anymore. Well, the conflict we're in now is definitely a religious one. Now we're seeing that, in this case, radical Islam is something that we have to contend with. And, of course, you contend with that, then other religious issues become, loom bigger and bigger and bigger. Are they right? Are they wrong? Why are they wrong? And so it really brings theology into the public square in a way it hadn't been for a long, long time.
What is the worst legacy of September 11th in the church?
Well, the worst legacy is the assumption that because this terrible thing happened, or these religious people, that it's caused a sort of tolerance kind of backlash, where now we have to see every religion as equally valid. Now, again, you would think that what happened really destroyed the ability to think in those terms. You need to see if a religion is true or false. Is it right or wrong? Instead, though, you have this sort of backlash of well, we have to affirm all religions, and we're having a sort of a new civil religion that's grown up. Civil religion is how a nation uses religious ideas or symbols to sort of bring people together. In our history, Christianity was used as a civil religion. Of course, they had to strip everything distinctly Christian about it, and so, God, America, apple pie, all of those things associated, but the, claims of Jesus Christ, wasn't really part of it, but you had a sort of a secularized religion. The new civil religion includes everyone, Christian, Islam, Hindus, the idea that really all good religions are, all of the world's religions are basically peaceful and equally valid and equal paths to the same God. And so we have a new kind of religious pluralism or even syncretism, having worship services where all of the different gods are invoked and are prayed to. And that's a radical change in our culture to look to the whole pantheon of religion. It's almost like a kind of neo-polytheism that we're seeing kind of develop in the culture, sort of the new civil religion. And that can be very, very, very dangerous, at least from a Christian point of view.
There was a very recent Gallup News Service poll, and it was asking people's attitudes post-September 11th and comparing them from 1 year ago, 1 year after the events. What I found interesting is that fewer people believe today than they did a year ago that time has healed the country's wounds. In answer to that question, 27% a year ago said that time had healed the country's wounds. When polled in August this year, only 21% believe that time had healed the country's wounds. Your reaction to this?
Well, that's probably healthy, because Americans, we tend to be have a very short attention span, and we tend to live in the moment, and we tend to be very impatient, and our attention goes from one thing to another, and that actually people are realizing that time hasn't healed the wounds of 9/11, or a bigger percentage of them. That's probably a healthy sign, because in dealing with not just the issues of terrorism and war, and but also I think the moral and spiritual issues that are with us, we can't just dismiss these things. We need to be in this sort of mode of, you know, thinking through these issues for the long term, and the real danger is that we will forget and have forgotten. And I think a lot of people have. No more people are flying flags, or few people are wearing them on their lapel. Few people are, but more importantly than that, than those kind of superficial maybe expressions, is how people are thinking about their country, how they're thinking about their security, how they're thinking about their faith or lack of faith. We need to remember. We need to continue to think through. We need to continue to learn from what happened, and we need to continue to be vigilant and to pull together and to get serious about these issues and to stay that way for a while.
I know that you are a keen observer of culture, and in particular of pop culture and the entertainment culture, Dr. Veith. Mm-hmm. I noted after September 11th, of course, it was natural that many popular entertainment shows just simply went off the air for a week or two. Major awards ceremonies were either canceled or postponed for some time after September 11th. And yet it seems in the 2 years since September 11th, pop culture has bounced back with a vengeance. Things more outrageous than we ever would have imagined even several years ago. What do you make of this?
Well, I think some people want escape. Now they feel that they're not completely secure, that there could be terrorism or anthrax or someone could strike any time. And one response to that is to escape. And the way we build for us to escape is in our pop culture and our entertainment. Even the so-called reality shows are sort of escapes, because they present a form of reality that's very entertaining. I think that's part of it. Part of it is that pop culture, by its definition, does have a short attention span, because there always has to be something new, you know, to keep the attention, and a new fashion to come up to get people to buy into it. I know tonight I noticed, I'm curious to see how this event is memorialized on television and the like. I am told that on Trio, one of the cable stations, they're showing a 9/11 documentary created by international filmmakers and others, and of course, and some of them are actually anti-American. That they have, the real 9/11 was September 11th. Some years before, when the Yankees imperialists overthrew, the Latin American dictator, and so there's less sensitivity about this issue now in the pop culture. And so I think while our pop culture has forgotten, I think they want to forget, they need to forget it. And for some ways, sometimes, you know, ordinary Americans want to forget all the dangers of the world and to retreat into the entertainment universe for a while.
With only a minute and a half before we have to wrap up our conversation, Dr. Veith, how should Christianity and Christians react in an age of terrorism?
Well, one thing I think Christians should do is to realize the difference. Realize that what we're up against in the radical Islam and all the other secular ideologies are versions of law, of legalism, of moralism, of force. Whereas Christianity is not supposed to have that spirit. Christianity is all about the gospel. It's about the cross, about Christ coming into the ground zeros of our lives, bringing us forgiveness and healing, not hate and revenge, which seems to motivate every other religion of the world, causing all of these wars and terrorist acts. But we need to have a different spirit as Christians. Yes, we need to defend ourselves. We need to defend our country. And we need to fight against evil in every way. And yet, the spiritual issue has to be Christ, and it's Him that we have to cling to in these times of uncertainty and insecurity and suffering and death. And if these events can drive us closer to Him, realize that He's in the middle of this with us, and that's something we've got to hold on to.
Dr. Gene Edward Veith, thank you very much for being our guest.
Yeah, my pleasure.
Dr. Gene Edward Veith is a regular guest here on Issues Etc. We got his reflections here 2 years after September 11th. He's professor of English and director of the Cronach Institute at Concordia University in Mequon, Wisconsin, culture editor for World Magazine, and author of several books, including Christianity in an Age of Terrorism. Now, that's a book that you can purchase by calling Concordia Publishing House at 1-800-325-3040, 1-800-325-3040, or you can order the book online at www.cph.org, www.cph.org. The book is called Christianity in an Age of Terrorism by Dr. Gene Edward Veith. When we come back from this break, Jennifer Roback Morse joins us. We're going to talk a little bit about sex as sport, the hookup culture. That's after the break. Christianity is uniquely qualified and positioned to look at the suffering of September 11th and see it rightly. Not only see the events as they actually occurred, without all the conspiracy theories and the political nonsense, but to see what this immense suffering actually points us to. Christians are those who affirm that they have been redeemed by human suffering, the suffering of Jesus Christ. That brings all of this into focus. We'll be right back.
A voice in the wilderness of American evangelicalism. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
If the book of Romans is Paul's treatise on justification by grace through faith, then the book of Colossians is Paul's treatise on Christ. What does Paul teach in the book of Colossians on the person and work of Jesus Christ? Our Issues, Etc. book of the month for September is the Concordia Commentary on the Book of Colossians by Dr. Paul Dieterding. The book costs $39.99 plus shipping and handling. You can order by calling Concordia Publishing House at 1-800-325-3040, 1-800-325-3040, or go online at issuesetc.org. Under the What's New section, you'll find information on the book. 1-800-325-3040, issuesetc.org. When you call or write, ask for the Issues Etc. Book of the Month for September.
Now this Global Minute focuses prayer on a girl in India who had no one to care for her, but now she knows her Father God loves her. Priyanka's mother died and her father suffered from the effects of alcoholism. Her grandmother couldn't care for her, but thankfully, she heard about a home of shelter and her grandmother brought Priyanka to the Ramabai Mukti Mission. India has more than 24 major languages, and Priyanka felt lost and alone because no one spoke her language. Her house mother made an extra special effort to comfort and prayed often that the Lord Jesus would hug Priyanka with his love. Recently, Priyanka's guardian read to her verses from Psalm 62 and 68 that say, God is the father to the fatherless, and he gives families to the lonely. Pray that Priyanka will grow to know Christ. Discover the ways that children in India find hope. Call 1-800-268-0461. That's 1-800-268-0461. Ask for Priyanka's story.
Welcome to the Meyer Minute. Today we remember. 170 guests and workers were trapped in Windows on the World, the restaurant on the 106th floor of the North Tower of the World Trade Center. Christine Olender, an assistant to the restaurant's general manager, telephoned Port Authority Police. She said, "The fresh air is going down fast. I'm not exaggerating." "Ma'am, I know you're not exaggerating," the police said. Down on the 64th floor of the same building, Patrick Hoy was told, "Stay near the stairwells and wait for the police to come up." Patrick and those with him waited for an hour and a half. He called back, "The smoke is getting kind of bad. We're contemplating going down the stairwell. Does that make any sense?" "Yes, try to get out," said the police. "All right, bye," said Mr. Hoy. There are countless more sad stories we shall always remember. From Psalm 11, "If the foundations are destroyed, what can the righteous do? The Lord tests the righteous, but his soul hates the wicked and the one who loves violence. The Lord is righteous. He loves righteous deeds. The upright shall behold his face." I'm Dale Meyer.
The Eugene Fieldhouse and St. Louis Toy Museum is sponsoring a day of identification and appraisal for teddy bears on Saturday, September 13th from 10 to 3. An experienced appraiser and a knowledgeable expert on teddy bears will be present at the museum to identify and appraise teddy bears. There will be a charge of $3 for the first bear and $2 for each additional bear, with a limit of 3 items per person. Admission to the museum and a century of teddy bears is $4 for adults and 50 cents for children under 12.
Tomorrow on Issues Etc., a two-hour conversation with the author of our Issues Etc. book of the month for September, the Concordia Commentary on Colossians. Dr. Paul Dieterding joins us. We'll do kind of the overview of Colossians with Dr. Dieterding tomorrow on the program. Also tomorrow, 1 hour of a conversation with Larry Rast on pietism. You know, you feel when you go to church that something has changed. You can't put your finger on it. You're wondering, what's different about my church that I didn't used to notice? Is it me? Is it the people around me? Is it this new pastor? You know, if that's the sinking feeling you have when you go to church, something's changed. Something big has changed, and I can't figure out what it is, and I'm sure it's not right. You need to listen to this hour with Dr. Larry Rast on pietism tomorrow on Issues Etc. It might be pietism. Jennifer Roback Morse joins us here for the remainder of the first hour of Issues Etc. We're going to talk about the hookup culture, sex as sport, as what? Recreation. Jennifer Roback Morse is a research fellow for the Hoover Institute, author of the book Love and Economics: Why the Laissez-Faire Family Doesn't the Laissez-Faire Family Doesn't Work, and she has written a column for To the Source titled The Hookup Culture. Jennifer, welcome back.
Thanks very much. Glad to be with you.
Our phone numbers are 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Give us a brief description of the hookup culture.
Well, the hookup culture, the idea of hooking up, is when a guy and a gal get together and have a sexual experience and they don't really expect anything else to come from it. It's fairly common on college campuses. It's fairly common among working singles. But and the idea, of course, behind it is that sex is really meant to be and should be simply a recreational activity that you don't assign very much meaning to. The relationship isn't the point. It's just the act itself that is the point. It's an end in itself, so to speak. And so that's what I wrote about, was what that culture is like and what it does to us.
Okay, so sex as sport. Draw the comparison that you do in this to the Source article. Draw the comparison. If we're going to say sex is sport, you say we don't have things like basketball game date crisis centers. We do have pregnancy centers or rape crisis centers. Draw the comparison for us.
Well, you know, the idea of the sexual revolution is that sex is just a recreational activity. It's just a sport. It's just something you do for fun. It doesn't have any particular meaning. And if you assign too much meaning to it, then there's something wrong with you, you know, and that what the way to liberate ourselves and the way to feel good is to not simply assign any meaning to our sexual activity. Just do what you want when you want to do it. Now, if that's true, that sex is no big deal, and that all we have to do is tell ourselves it's no big deal, then it's very hard to make sense of the kinds of things that sometimes go on college campuses, including the fact that there is a proliferation of date rape crisis centers. Now, some of your listeners may know about this, some may not know about it, but what date rape is called is sometimes called acquaintance rape, where you go out on a date with somebody, you have a sexual encounter, and afterwards you say that you were raped, that it was not a voluntary sexual encounter, it was a rape. Now, sometimes what happens in these encounters, first of all, let me say, there are certainly cases where that's what happened, where it's a rape without any adjectives attached to it, it's just plain vanilla rape. But quite often what happens is that there was some confusion about whether it's voluntary or not voluntary. He says, gee, I thought she wanted to have sex, and so I went ahead and had sex. And she says, well, no, I didn't really like it that much, or I told him to stop, or I changed my mind. And that kind of ambivalence on her part becomes the basis for a charge of date rape. Now, what's interesting about that, there are many interesting things about it, of course, but one of the interesting things about it is that if all it is a bit of confusion about who really wants this or that or the other thing, why would you assign so much meaning to a little bit of a misunderstanding? You know, if I take you out to a basketball game, let's say you take me out on a date to a basketball game, and I say, gee, you know, I changed my mind. I don't want to be here. I'd rather go home. And he insists on staying for the whole thing, and we have a little conflict about it. It's not a crisis when that happens most of the time. If you want Chinese and I want Mexican and I let myself get talked into Chinese, it's not a crisis most of the time. It's just no big deal. But the fact is that when you get, quote, talked into sex, or when you have a sexual experience that you kind of change your mind about, it is a big deal, you see. It really is a big deal. And the fact is, we can't help ourselves. We assign meaning to our sexual behavior, whether we like it or not, even though we're being instructed left, right, and center that we shouldn't assign too much meaning to our sexual encounters. We do this. And so that, I think, is one of the real puzzles. If we're supposed to believe that sex is just a recreational activity, why is it that a bit of unwanted sex is a big crisis for somebody? How can that be? And I think any serious person knows that what's really going on is that sex is a big deal. And we're kidding ourselves when we say that it isn't a big deal and we shouldn't treat it as a big deal. But that is an act of self-deception on our parts. And I think if we think about it very long, if we have any experience at all, we realize that that's the case.
Trace the historical roots, if you would, for us, of the hookup culture. When does this begin?
Well, you know, that's an interesting question. I really can't completely trace the whole history of the sexual revolution, but I do think one of the watershed moments in our cultural history would certainly be in the early 1970s when colleges started to have co-educational dormitories. I really think that's one of the big factors that contributes to the hookup culture, particularly on college campuses. Because what the co-ed dorm does is make it possible for there to be lots and lots of occasions for students to have sexual encounters. Nobody's even attempting any longer to monitor sexual behavior. And so what happens is a kind of a new kind of morality develops, and the morality has to do with respecting your roommate's privacy when they have their boyfriend over. You know, it's not that there's no moral code. It's a different moral code about different kinds of things. So I'm not supposed to be bothering my roommate if she's got her boyfriend over. I'm not supposed to ask too many questions if she stays out all night. You know, that sort of thing takes place, and people can have sexual encounters without anywhere near as much planning or thought or deliberation as would have been required in the old days where men lived in one dorm and women lived in another dorm. You know, it just changed the whole dynamic of male-female relationships on campus. And so whatever else you can say about the history of the hookup culture and the history of the sexual revolution, I think you can surely say that 1971, when Oberlin College had the first co-ed dormitory, that was a watershed moment in American cultural history.
Would you go so far as to say that the hookup culture is at least the latest manifestation or the logical outcome of the feminists' doctrine of women and sex and sexual liberation?
Well, you know, I think they certainly occurred together. There are a couple of things coming together to make the hookup culture happen. One is a particular brand of feminism, and I mean, I think you're quite right about that. The idea that for women to be equal to men, they have to be able to have sexuality on the same terms as men. But it's coupled with that also, of course, the technology of birth control pills, which made low-cost, high-reliability contraception possible. Without that being available, the culture could never have gone in the direction that it did. You know, it'd just be there'd be too many risks. You know, it would be too implausible to say that you should be allowed to have sex without any kind of consequences. So the birth control pill is obviously a crucial factor. But the other crucial factor, I think, is a sort of a misunderstanding, really, about what human sexuality is all about, even for men. I mean, I think behind the sexual revolution is a very immature and kind of caricature of what sexuality means for men. In other words, men do go around sowing their wild oats, and that's what matters to men, and that's what men want, and that's what they're entitled to. And since they're entitled to that, equality requires that we have access to that as well. Well, the fact of the matter is that isn't really true of men. You know, that's an unfair thing to be saying about men, although many men can remember behaving in that way. But the fact is, I think, that most men outgrow that and come to see that it isn't really as fun as they thought, that they develop attachments to their female partners and they want to matter to their partner. They don't want to be treated like a throwaway object, and they don't want to treat people like a throwaway object. And that's really what we have ended up doing. As we move into a hookup kind of mentality, where the other person is simply there to be a source of gratification for us, the other person is not a partner. The other person is kind of an object that satisfies me more or less well, and I'm entitled to take whatever pleasure they will allow me to take, and move on to my next encounter, whatever it might be, without any kind of real human connection to that person. I think to act as if that was ever the norm for most men, I just think is really, really unfair to men to talk about them like that. And so what this particular form of the women's movement did was to aspire to doing kind of the worst thing that men have ever been charged with doing, which is to treat sex so casually that the human person behind the sexual act is lost.
We're talking with Jennifer Roback Morse, research fellow for the Hoover Institute, author of the book Love and Economics, Why the Laissez-Faire Family Doesn't Work. She has written a column for To the Source titled The Hookup Culture. You can read this column at tothesource.org. It's To the Source, all one word, .org. You mentioned unwanted sexual activity. Americans have been watching the Kobe Bryant case. I have wondered often, given the hookup culture, whether or not both the accuser and the accused could be actually right, in a sense, that Kobe says, look, we were just hooking up.
Right.
It wasn't a big deal. Well, she says, well, you know, I might have wanted to hook up, but then when I was ready for it to stop, I was ready for it to stop. But he was just hooking up. It was no big deal. No
right.
Personal commitment here.
I hesitate to speak about the Kobe Bryant case in particular because more facts will keep emerging about it, you know, and so it's hard to say right now how that's going to come down. But I think in general, that is what you just said is absolutely correct. That, I think, is the norm in date rape cases. If you can't show physical evidence of a force taking place, and both parties admit that something sexual happened, and one party claims it was forced and the other party claims it isn't forced, if you can't demonstrate some kind of physical evidence that shows something about coercion, torn clothes or a broken bed or, you know, something that demonstrates something happened, the scenario you described is pretty much what you're left with. You can't tell what really happened. You can't tell whether they both consented to it immediately and then one of them had mixed feelings later, or just what. You can't tell. And so I think the scenario you describe is probably pretty common. The sad thing is that in some cases, you know, male students end up facing rather severe disciplinary consequences on campuses with no more evidence than she said so, you know. And that's too bad. And of course, Kobe Bryant is in this situation where if he is found guilty of the charges, he's facing a long time in prison. You know, this is a very serious kind of charge. And so naturally, he's going to fight it with everything that he can. And I think it's going to be very interesting to see how they figure out exactly what happened, how we get to the bottom of a case like this. And I think also that it's emblematic of our treating sexuality in such a casual way that we end up with a case like this where the ambiguity that people sometimes feel around sexuality becomes a matter for a court case. And if we let things go on as far as we have, I think it's only natural that you're going to end up with more and more of these ambiguous cases, some of which really truly do go over the line of genuine consent and genuine, where there probably is something that anybody would say if they were watching, they would say, yes, this was coercion. But what we're doing is that we have said that the only standard of what is good or bad sex, there's only one thing that tells you whether it's good sex, and that is if it was voluntary. If it's coerced, it's bad, it's rape. But if it's voluntary, it's good. That's what the sexual revolution says. That's the only criterion we have for judging the moral appropriateness of sex. Well, when you do that, any kind of unsatisfactory experience that you might have, you don't have any vocabulary for really describing the fact that this encounter didn't seem right to you. And so I think sometimes it does happen that a woman will say, you know, I didn't like this, and it just felt all wrong. And the vocabulary she has for describing that was, oh, gosh, I didn't really want it after all, because that's the only thing she's allowed to say that says, in fact, this was bad sex. She knew it was bad sex from her experience, but the only thing she's allowed to say about bad sex is that it was somehow coerced.
There's a very famous cable television program, Sex and the City,
yes,
where the premise is women who are living out the sexual revolution as liberated women. And what strikes me as odd about that is that these women, if you watch it over the course of a season, are all uniformly very dissatisfied with their lives. I mean, they've got great lives living, you know, in the bright lights in the big city, but they're all dissatisfied. They're looking for something. What does this tell you?
I think that's really an interesting thing because it suggests, in a way, I heard one commentator say that Sex in the City is really a commercial for traditional morality. They don't advertise it that way, but that's really what it is, because if you watch this and take it seriously, you realize all of this modern sexual revolution stuff is making people miserable. So that if you really looked at it through just slightly different lens, you would see that it's a cautionary tale against engaging in participating in the sexual revolution, that you'd be better off with the traditional morality. I think that is what it's telling you, and I think that the producers of the program had no intention of it telling you that. You know, they had something quite different in mind, but I think the program took a rather dark turn just for it to be realistic.
Let's see if we can look off into the future a little bit here, Jennifer. We have young adults in high school, in some cases junior high, too, junior high, high school, and especially college, who are living the hookup culture. No commitment, one night. We used to be called the one-night stand, which was a derogatory term. Now, apparently, that's A-okay. As young adults, they're doing this. What happens when they graduate from college and they get out there and they're becoming husbands and wives and mothers and fathers?
Well, I think one of the things that happens, one of the things that I've observed is that, first of all, among young people, there's a lot of kind of blowback, you might say, from the divorce culture that is a part of what is going on in young people's sexual lives. And I think you and I have talked about this before. I think young people, many of them have been through divorce already, and they don't want that for themselves and for their children. And so in some cases, they see hooking up as a way of satisfying some of their needs without getting too involved, right? And they have hesitation about getting too involved. They also sometimes see cohabitation as a substitute for marriage as a way to protect themselves from further hurt without getting... Because marriage seems to be so risky for them. And so what, in a sense, what looks like wild, modern, liberated behavior is in some ways avoidance behavior. It's in some ways risk-averse behavior, trying to minimize the risk of being harmed or wounded by emotional entanglements. So that's one of the factors that I think is driving some of the people's motivation. And but the sad thing about that, though, is that both of those kinds of things, either the hooking up or the cohabitation, both of those things are very poor preparation for marriage, and in fact they're counterproductive for marriage. And so it's kind of sad in a way that you have people who, young people who very much want to make married life work, who very much want to get married and make it last. They don't have the tools on hand to know how to do that, and some of the things they're doing are really actively getting in their way. You know, cohabitation increases the probability of divorce. It doesn't reduce the probability, it increases the probability of divorce. So it's really one of the dumber things you can do if you want to have lifelong love, you know. But young people don't have anybody telling them that. And so they're sort of stumbling into these things because their elders are telling them morally neutral sex is the right thing to do, that sex is just nothing more than a recreational activity. But someday you're going to meet Mr. Right and you're going to settle down and it's going to be forever and it's all going to change and mean so much to you. It doesn't make any sense, you know. We're not really giving young people very constructive guidance in this area.
You know, it strikes me that little bit of advice you just articulated there to the young people, to me sounds like more fanciful, more naive than any advice ever given by the father to daughter who says, young lady, you are now of courting age and young men will come a-calling and I will one day give your hand in marriage. You know, that sounds quaint to the sexual revolution generation.
Right, right.
But that little scenario you just laid out sounds so naive and so fanciful.
Right.
You're going to fool around and then you'll meet Mr. Right and then you'll have the storybook marriage.
Right, and then sex has absolutely no meaning at all right up until the moment that you want it to have meaning, and then it will be endowed with all sorts of meaning. You know, I mean, that doesn't add up. That just really doesn't add up when you think it through. And I think the human body being what it is and the human propensity to sin being built into the body the way that it is, we want to hear that it's okay to do what our body seems to be calling us to do. You know, we want to believe that it's okay to act upon the impulses, to act on the passions, to play out the passions. So when somebody tells you that, you know, sex is no big deal, there's a certain time in our lives when we're very receptive to hearing that, you know. But then after you have some experience, you go, gee, there's something wrong with this picture. Something is not adding up about what I've been told. It would be helpful if people had someplace to turn to help them make sense of the fact that they just did something stupid, rather than to have the whole culture pat them on the back and say, you know, you really aren't feeling anything badly about this whole thing. The fact that you want the guy to call you back, you know, just put that out of your mind. That's for wimps. That's for losers. You don't need him to call. Stand up on your own two feet. You know, that's the kind of messages young girls receive, you know. And that seems to me to be quite crazy. You know, it's just crazy. You can't possibly mean it. And what you're telling people is that the pain that you feel over your isolation, the pain you feel over wondering whether the guy's going to call you, wondering whether anything's going to come of it, your desire to be attached to him, all of that grief that you're feeling, you're supposed to ignore that. That you're not supposed to consider that as a cost of what you're doing, a cost big enough to dissuade you from doing it again. You know, you're supposed to put that out of your mind and just go enjoy the next encounter. And to describe that as a morally neutral position, that is just not accurate. It is a highly moral position, but it's just a very twisted sort of moral code. They're telling you you have a moral obligation to disregard the desire for permanence and the desire for sexual exclusivity, the desire to be special. You are morally required to disregard all of those feelings. You know, and that's what it takes to participate in the hookup culture. That's what it takes to go back to the well again and try to somehow make the next encounter better than the last one. And the fact is, it just doesn't work out very well. And I think it's helpful for people to hear that they're not the only ones who feel that there's something strange about this whole thing.
Jennifer Roback Morse, thank you for being our guest on Issues Etc.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Jennifer Roback Morse is a research fellow for the Hoover Institute and author of the book Love and Economics, Why the Laissez-Faire Family Doesn't Work. You can purchase her book by calling Spence Publishing at 1-888-SPEN-PUB, 1-888-SPEN-PUB, that's S-P-E-N-P-U-B, or you can order Love and Economics by Jennifer Roback Morse at www.spencepublishing.com. You can buy the book now for 50% off, www.spencepublishing.com. The book is called Love and Economics, Why the Laissez-Faire Family Doesn't Work. You can also read the column that she has written for To The Source, titled The Hookup Culture, by going to their website, tothesource.org, to the source, all one word, .org. When we start Hour 2 of Issues Etc., Pastor Tim Pauls joins us. We will talk about the soldier's vocation. He's pastor of Good Shepherd Lutheran Church in Boise, Idaho, and author of a column in the latest edition of the Lutheran Witness titled, A Godly Vocation. Is the soldier's a godly vocation? Or is it something that we say, it's nothing like that, it's a thing all unto itself? Does God call men, and I guess in this day and age today, women, to be soldiers, to wage war? We'll talk about that when we come back. Stay with us.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for Issues Etc. to continue. Our address is Post Office Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri 63117. Or you can contact us via our website at www.issuesetc.org. That's www.issuesetc.org. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-800-737-0172. That's 1-800-737-0172. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of this station or the Jubilee Network. Issues Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.